You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show, Kiev offers an olive branch to pro-Russian separatists in the east of the country. Will the Russians accept Prime Minister Yatsenyuk's offer? Jeffrey Kaufman and Nina Schick will give us their view. Then we find out why, despite the relative success of Obamacare, the President's Secretary of Health is resigning.
The personal reward for me at the end of the day are the folks who approach me, the strangers who approach me at a meeting or pass me a note on a plane or hand me a phone with someone on the other end saying thank you.
We'll also be heading to Milan to hear why Berlusconi might get community service instead of house arrest, and we'll check out what films are getting a standing ovation at this year's Hong Kong Film Festival. So, lots coming up in this Friday edition of Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. But before all that, here is Jonathan Weirdly with the latest news.
Ukraine is expected to dominate talks between finance officials from the G20 nations on the sidelines of the International Monetary Fund meetings in Washington. The news comes as Russia has been suspended from the Council of Europe in protest against Moscow's build-up of 40,000 troops on its border with Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea. Well, the US Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland said the Obama administration is now launching a so-called truth-telling campaign on Ukraine to counter what she called Russian lies ahead of May's elections.
You know, one cannot match the kind of money and effort in a closed society that Russia is putting into this, but we can certainly help our friends and partners debunk lies, get the straight story out. So we have redirected a great amount of public diplomacy funds to mounting our own truth-telling campaign.
Meanwhile, in eastern Ukraine, armed pro-Russian separatists continue to occupy two official buildings in Luhansk and Donetsk, calling for a referendum like that held in Crimea. Rebel leader Mini Menawi from Sudan's Darfur region has today accused international peacekeepers of deliberately turning a blind eye to what he called a renewed campaign of ethnic cleansing by government-backed Arab militias. International efforts have largely failed to end the violence, more than 10 years after Khartoum unleashed militias to try and crush a rebellion by mostly non-Arab insurgents. Peter Greste's mother, Lois, has today said that the latest hearing of her son's trial in court in Cairo is farcical. Peter Greste is one of three Al Jazeera journalists who are on trial on charges of aiding a terrorist organization. Their trial resumed yesterday, only to adjourn until later this month.
Peter sounded so good. In fact, we even cracked a joke, and I heard him laugh, which was absolutely wonderful. So he was in good spirits on Wednesday night, and even yesterday I think he held up well in the court. But I feel heartbroken, absolutely, and I feel also exasperated.
The Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott said in Shanghai today that he's confident that rescuers know the position of flight MH370's black box. Abbott said the search for the missing jetliner is probably the most difficult search in human history. 15 aircraft and 13 ships search for the missing plane today, a day after an Australian AP-3C Orion aircraft detected another possible signal. Three activists rallying for international intervention in South Sudan have been arrested in New York for disorderly conduct. The activists, along with 24 demonstrators, were protesting against recent ethnic violence in South Sudan that has left thousands dead. Joe Madison is a radio show presenter and a South Sudanese supporter.
Now is the time for the United States, the United Nations, and yes, the world to step up. I know we're focused on the Ukraine. But right now, there are more people dying in South Sudan than in the Ukraine. There are tens of thousands who have died.
And finally, in Missouri, in the United States, seven chimpanzees used an improvised ladder from a tree to scale a wall and briefly escape their enclosure at the Kansas City Zoo. One of the chimps apparently pulled a log or a branch and leaned it against the wall of the enclosure, giving the primates a leg up to the top. They were clearly monkeying around. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
We'll get more news from Jonathan Wheatley in 25 minutes. Meanwhile, you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, you London. This is Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time is 21:06 in Moscow, 18:06 here in London, and it is 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with his take on the news here in the studio is Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent with ABC News America. Welcome to the program. Actually, Nina Schick from Open Europe Think Tank is going to join us as well in just a few minutes.
She'll have a traffic report before we actually talk about the news.
She's in touch with you already, so she's probably walking
We're
in.
We're waiting anxiously.
She's walking in a couple of minutes, I bet. Anyway, let's start straight away with today's news. There's quite a lot going on. If we start with US politics then, President Obama had a surprise win this month when enrollment figures for the Obamacare surpassed 7 million. That was the number the administration was hoping to achieve, but seemed unlikely after last year's technical glitches associated with the website. Well, despite this, a last-minute surge provided a big win for the president. So why now then did Kathleen Sebelius, the Health and Human Services Secretary, resign? What is behind this surprise resignation when she didn't resign last year when there actually seemed to be so many more problems? What is your take on that?
I think it's a simple word, exhaustion. I mean, she saw things through. She took a lot of rocks and a lot of harsh words directed at her for the really, really bad rollout, the failure of healthcare.gov, the government's, the Obamacare website that failed miserably last fall. But she stuck it with it. She oversaw the corrections, the website improved, and despite all of the chicken littles, they not only met their objective of 7 million enrollees, they actually seem to have hit 7.5 million. So, she's done her job. She's been Secretary of Health and Human Services since 2009. These are exhausting jobs. That's 5 years on the front lines, and clearly this has been a year in which she's been beaten up badly, and who can blame her?
I'm still thinking about this very moment when we get those figures. 7.5 million people enrolled is a massive figure, and this is a huge victory for her.
Well, it's... I guess it'll be easier to judge this in a couple of years to see just where Obamacare goes. Should there be a Republican administration, can they undo this? I mean, the interesting thing about this 7.5 million figure is it is a critical mass. And the question is, if the Republicans continue, as they are certain to do, to run on a platform of dismantling Obamacare, are these 7.5 million people, not all of whom are voters, because obviously some are children, but a good number of millions are voters, will they be mobilized to say, you better vote for the Democrats, Hillary Clinton, or whoever the nominee is, because you will lose your health care if the Republicans get in? And so there is an interesting dynamic unfolding here as the Republicans refuse to budge in their stance of dismantling Obamacare.
Do you think this resignation is going to weaken Obama in any way?
I think Obama's pretty weak right now anyway. I mean, I think Obama has had so many setbacks and he's just in such a polarized state. I mean, look at him globally. We'll talk about Ukraine in a moment, I'm sure. But, you know, his foreign policy has really proven to be limp in Syria and Ukraine and in dealing with Russia. Domestically, I think despite his best efforts, he just has not been able to get traction. The Republicans have done everything they can in the most polarized atmosphere imaginable in the U.S. Congress to undermine him, and they've succeeded an awful lot despite his success with Obamacare, which may well be his lasting legacy. But I think, there's a strange phenomenon. We're approaching midterm elections, his second term, and this you're going to start hearing the term lame duck president that comes in the last 2 years of a presidency. I mean, it's an absurd notion that you're an impotent president for 2 years of your 8 years in office. But that is the kind of terminology that's been used, and it precedes Obama.
And also thinking about how the GOP is going to use this resignation to their advantage.
Well, I don't know that they can use it to their advantage. I really think that Sebelius can hold her head high, and they really blew it at the beginning of the rollout of healthcare.gov. It was just an absolute mess, both in terms of the ability of people to enroll, but also the public relations. And for such a controversial piece of legislation, they were just handing on a silver platter the critiques and the vulnerabilities of this to the Republican opponents. But Sebelius, you don't resign in the midst of a crisis. You resign once it's resolved. And I have not seen anything that suggests that she's doing anything but saying, I've done my job. It's time for somebody else to take over. She's got to be exhausted. These are such tough jobs. And when you imagine that she was such a polarizing figure and took so much abuse for what were mistakes that she was responsible for.
You need a very strong character in that job. And how easy is it going to be then to replace Sebelius?
Well, I think Sebelius has done much of the hard work. I mean, healthcare.gov is working. 7.5 million people are enrolled. Now, I guess that the challenge is to make sure that the insurance actually delivers. What we're seeing, I was just reading this week, there is a serious skew towards elderly and less than healthy people amongst those 7.5 million. So the actuaries and the insurance companies are going to be reassessing this when they reopen enrollment and say, wait a minute, maybe our fees are a bit low. Maybe we can't quite afford what we're offering. Those are the kind of things that her successor is going to have to deal with. And this is not going to be a perfect rollout in terms of the actual access to health care. That's not necessarily within the Secretary of HHS's mandate or purview to soften the way for individuals. But there will be criticisms that things aren't coming fast enough. But, the overwhelming theme for these 7.5 million people is, finally, I have health care.
Mm-hmm.
And Sebelius does get a lot of the credit for that, as well as Obama.
Well, there's one name we should discuss. Sylvia Burwell, President Barack Obama's expected choice to run the Department of Health and Human Services from this on. How much do we know about her?
She's been a cabinet level appointment for what, a year or two in the management office, she had a senior position in the Walmart Foundation, as I recall. She has a lot of management experience. She's an insider in the Obama group, in the Obama cabinet. She's already at the table. So, he clearly decided to choose someone who he can trust, who knows the system, who's familiar with the nature of the pressures and who can just pick up where Sebelius has left off.
And do we know what Sebelius is going to do from this on? Just take it extremely easy.
I don't know about her, but if I were her, I'd be going to some desert island with nice warm breezes and sandy beach and putting my feet up for a couple of weeks or months and just disappearing from the political radar. I people like this are highly employable, despite the polarized nature of Washington. There are so many groups, corporations, think tanks, universities who would love to have her. She understands understandably, like any cabinet level officer, can really write her own ticket at some point. And she'll, you know, she'll go on the speaking tour. She might write a book. You know, these are fairly predictable paths. Maybe she'll go in some other direction. But she has many, many options.
And just one more question about Burwell. So Sibelius passed a big hurdle. What is Burwell's next big hurdle then?
I haven't seen targets for the next enrollment period, but clearly they want to get these numbers up and they want to get a critical mass. You know, this is an ideological fight for the Democrats, the notion of bringing health insurance to so many millions. You have 40 million Americans without health insurance. Now we've taken seen them take 7.5 million off that. That's about 20%. They want to knock that number down. And clearly, the more they can get down, the more they prove the need and the appetite for this. But ultimately, these are people who one would assume will become very loyal Democratic voters.
Let's move on to our second top story today, which is the continuing crisis in Ukraine. The country's prime minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, was in Donetsk today and offered to devolve more powers to Ukraine's eastern regions in a bid to scale back concerns that the country could be on the brink of a civil war. He was meeting regional leaders as pro-Russian separatists continued to defy Kiev. Let's take a listen to what Yatsenyuk had to say.
I do believe that we need to tackle this problem only in a peaceful manner. But we've made an offer. They are to leave the premise of the state administration, to be disarmed, and we as a state of Ukraine can guarantee them that they won't be detained or arrested.
This also comes the day after Russia threatened to scale back its gas supplies to both Ukraine and also to much of Europe. So, do we think that leaders in Ukraine's east will buy what Kiev has to sell? And what happens to the country's supply of gas? What do we know about this offer by Kiev, first of all?
Well, first of all, you know, clearly Kiev is trying to defuse a situation before it becomes explosive. What's unclear, although becoming more clear, is just what's motivating and who's behind these pro-Russian forces or protesters in eastern Ukraine. There are accusations, including by the United States, that this is not simply a groundswell of support for Russia. That in fact Russia is planting people into these crowds to rile them up and to mobilize them to destabilize Ukraine and to increase their claims of credible claims that they really should have more than Crimea within Russia. So what the acting president of Ukraine, Alexander Turchynov, is trying to do here is diffuse this to say, listen, we don't want to see bloodshed. We don't want to go in and see people killed. You guys just back off and we'll just let bygones be bygones. He's trying to take the high road. The thing is that Russia is very much driving this. And, you know, it may be in Russia's interest to see people, pro-Russian supporters in Ukraine killed to mobilize. I mean, I think there's every reason to be as cynical as you can possibly be about Russia's motives and Russia's words here.
At the same time, is there any reason to believe that this kind of an offer would help anyway? Will the eastern regions be happy with this kind of offer?
In terms of devolution, you know, Crimea was already an autonomous republic. You know, to be clear, there has already been a form of devolution within Ukraine. It's hard to know. It's really not a question, frankly, of what the people in Ukraine think. It's a question of what the Kremlin thinks and whether the Kremlin what kind of chess game the Kremlin is in the process of playing and what their ultimate goal is here.
And what do we know about Russian supplies of gas? Will Ukraine pay up its debt? And if not, what happens? Will we see what happened in 2009?
You know, when these pipelines were built in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan, in his wisdom, as polarizing a figure as he is, said, this is a bad idea. We are letting Europe become dependent on Russian gas, and they are going to use this as a political tool someday. And prophetically, he was right. it's right now being used against Ukraine, but it's being called an economic weapon, and that's exactly what Putin is doing in raising gas prices 80% to Ukraine, which is you know effectively bankrupt. Mm-hmm. He is simply tightening the screws, and Ukraine is going, wait a minute, you know, we have $2.2 billion dollars in obligations to Russia. We'll try to honor that, but you can't go and raise it. Our 2013 agreement said that this is the rate we would pay. You can't suddenly in 2014 go and raise it this much. It's so clearly a manipulative effort by Putin to throw Ukraine off. Of course, what's interesting is if you look at a map of these pipelines going from Russia to one goes into Germany, one goes into Italy. They both go through Ukraine. So there's an interesting problem for Russia here, which is they can say we're not going to let Ukraine have any gas. They need to sell gas to make money. The Russian economy, part of what Putin's doing here is distracting from the fact that he is presiding over an economy that is simply that lives solely on the sale of resources, largely gas and oil. He needs the revenue from Germany and Italy and Western Europe. It's easy for him to say we're not going to sell any more to Ukraine, but those pipelines go through there, and you know it's not a stretch to say that Ukraine's going to say, "Excuse me, you want to sell gas? You want our gas to go through our country? We're going to take some."
Jeffrey, looking at this crisis, who is going to blink first in all of this?
Well, I think the West's already blinked. I don't think there's any question here. I think that Putin is, you know, that sound that we're hearing is the clinking of vodka glasses in the Kremlin. I mean, Putin is just gleeful right now. You know, here's the problem. Ukraine matters, but it doesn't strategically matter that much. It's not a NATO member. It's far from Western Europe. And it just isn't such an important player. There's just no way, you know, we've talked about this before, there's simply no way that NATO, the US, the UK are going to mobilize forces to bring Crimea back. I guess the question is, with so many, one of the things we haven't talked about is these satellite photographs that came out yesterday that show huge massing of Russian forces, jets and helicopters and troops within 30 miles of the Ukrainian border. What is Putin's endgame here? Is he simply doing this for intimidation? He's claiming it's simply a military exercise, which is utterly absurd given the scale of forces that these satellite images show. But what's his endgame? And does he really plan to go into Donetsk and the other regions of eastern Ukraine and annex them as well? Is there a point at which it becomes unpalatable for the West? You know, he knows that he can push so far before something will have to be done. We don't know where that line is, but so far, there's no question the West has blinked.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi, and Jeffrey Kaufman. Nina Schick is going to join us in a minute as well. And when we return, we'll discuss why the United Nations is sending a peacekeeping force to the Central African Republic, and we hear why it is now illegal for some French citizens to work past 6 p.m.
If you thought Vancouver fashion was just about open-toed sandals and fleeces, think again. Local clothing brands are on the rise, giving the city a stylish boost. Monocle Films headed to the West Coast to meet forward-thinking retailers.
We first opened this location in Chinatown in 2011, and it was really new at that time. There wasn't too much really going on in the neighborhood. We're pretty much one of the only ones on the block. But since then, it has grown quite a bit. It's become a really great little, kind of like if you know, then you know kind of places.
Fashion City, Vancouver. Now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are wrapping up some of the big stories of the day with Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC News America and Nina Schick from Open Europe. Let's turn our attention now to the Central African Republic. The United Nations Security Council voted to approve a peacekeeping force of 12,000 soldiers to the Central African Republic in a bid to ease escalating violence between Christians and Muslims in the country. Some in the international community say there are serious concerns that CAR could become another Rwanda. So with 12,000 more troops joining the already 2,000 French troops, will this do anything? Nina Schick, welcome to the program. What is your view on this?
Well, it's the most significant contribution that the UN has made to date when it comes to the conflict in the Central African Republic. The interesting thing is that the troops won't actually deploy until September, and until then, the country will be very much left in the hands of the smaller French troops that are there, the EU troops that have been committed recently and just started arriving yesterday, and the African Union force. So whether or not it's enough remains to be seen, but more importantly, these troops won't be arriving until much later this year, so the fear is that the violence will escalate significantly.
There's actually quite a long way. Jeffrey, Central African Republic needs to wait until September before these 12,000 troops actually arrive. It's quite a long wait, isn't it?
Well, you know, and to talk about violence escalating, it's already there. It's already escalated. We're talking about, you know, lynchings, decapitations, gang rapes, just horrific, horrific violence that's going on with impunity. And so I think we're really talking about it continuing. And of course, the nature of this kind of violence, when people get away with it, they simply feel that's a carte blanche to continue. And that's what's so worrisome. It really is. It's a wretched situation. The UN has been slow to move. Ban Ki-moon, who was there recently, compared it to Rwanda and said, you know, he worries about some form of ethno-religious cleansing. What you have here is an anti-Muslim cleansing. The Muslims responsible, a Muslim rebel group responsible for taking power and throwing out the president last year, and now the Muslim leader has stepped down, and now all sorts of backlashes. As this, it is a bit of a Hutu versus Tutsi kind of ethnic clash that's going on here.
And the Central African Republic is a big country. It's about the size of Texas. And when we think of, you know, necessary numbers of troops, how is it possible to keep civilians safe throughout the country with any number?
Well, exactly. And of course, that's the issue here. And perhaps one of the most worrying developments in this is that some of the troops that were in the African Union forces who are currently in the country have actually, the troops from Chad have been asked to leave because they were found of indiscriminately firing against civilians as well. So as Jeffrey said, this is already violence on a tremendous scale. And well, yeah. Basically, very much similar to what we saw in Rwanda in the 1990s.
Let's leave this discussion and let's head to France next. It is 27 minutes past 6 o'clock here in London. But if we were in France and if we were signed to a certain type of contract, it might be illegal for us to be at work. A new law passed last night will make it illegal for certain employers to make their employees pick up the phone, answer emails, or do any work after 6 p.m. Some of the companies affected include Google, PricewaterhouseCoopers, and even Facebook. So is this plan a good idea? That is the first question. What is your view, Jeffrey?
Well, I think if I were a worker, the thing about France is that we all want the best of France, whether it's the food, the culture, the landscape, or the 35-hour work week. It's all brilliant, except that you have to look at France, which really cannot afford to do anything more to chase away employment and investment. And this is, you know, it's charming, it's funny, but the notion that Google can't email its employees, this is in a country that has had record high unemployment, 11%, that is seeing anemic growth, barely ahead of Argentina and Spain. If it hits 1% this year, it'll be doing well. Here in the UK, we're expecting 2.5%. This is, you know, it is funny, but in many ways, it's no joke. The French, as much as you have to admire their independence and their determination to maintain a quality of life, may well be tightening the noose around their neck. And you know, people who look at what's happening here in Europe, at the crisis in Portugal, Spain, Greece, and Italy, what they don't understand when you talk to economists is that France actually may well end up in that group as well.
Nina, do you understand this new legislation? Do you have any more understanding?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story, but the fact is that it's somehow been misrepresented in the Anglo-Saxon press. It's being reported as France makes it illegal to work after 6 p.m. But actually, what the directive actually says is that you cannot fire employees if they don't respond to their emails after 6 p.m. And it doesn't apply to all employees, only executives. So it's a great story. It reinforces our stereotypes of the French, whether they're romantic or whether they're lazy, but actually it's been misrepresented.
Well, I think that's fair. I mean, you're right that they, when they said it was a million, it only affects a quarter million workers. It's true, but the reality is that France is allowing the trade unions to do this, and there's deals are being signed, and you know, perception becomes reality. And when in France there are, where you already have this extraordinarily high income tax of 70%, where you have the 35-hour work week, do you think Google is going to put any more employees in France than it absolutely has to when it sees this kind of
absolutely don't contest the state of the French economy. However, in this, for this story in particular, I was just pointing out.
Can I just give my own Nordic view to this business, coming from there where you know, they don't do that many working hours, let's face it. It's been talked about that when you limit working hours, people actually end up working more efficiently when they get more rest. Do you think it could actually work this way? That these people, these few people in France who are not allowed to check their emails after 6 o'clock are actually going to prove to be more efficient employees?
I mean, there's a lot of research that backs that view that if you have a healthy work-life balance, you actually become a more effective employee. But again, still, the point is that this story has been overblown in the press. And I agree with Jeffrey that, you know, the French economy is in dire states. And in fact, the new prime minister will be hoping to make some reforms to the labor market.
That being said, I'm happy to move to France, work 35 hours a week, not take phone calls between 6 p.m. and 9 a.m. If I can find a job.
Exactly. So that's for our French
That's
for our French listeners. Greetings
exactly.
from Jeffrey Kaufman. Thank you very much, Jeffrey, and thank you very much, Nina Schick, for joining us here at Midori House, and have a great weekend as well.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there is plenty more to come on the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be in Milan to hear why Silvio Berlusconi is looking at community service instead of house arrest. And we'll also discuss Asian films at the Hong Kong Film Festival. But before we get started on that, here is Jonathan Weedley with the World News Headlines.
Thank you very much. Ukraine is expected to dominate talks between finance officials from the G20 nations on the sidelines of the International Monetary Fund meetings in Washington today. The news comes as in the east of the country, armed pro-Russian separatists continue to occupy two official buildings, Luhansk and Donetsk, calling for a referendum like that held in Crimea. Rebel leader Mini Menawi from Sudan's Darfur region has today accused international peacekeepers of deliberately turning a blind eye to what he called a renewed campaign of ethnic cleansing by government-backed Arab militias. International efforts have largely failed to end the violence more than 10 years after Khartoum unleashed militias to try and crush a rebellion by mostly non-Arab insurgents. Peter Greste's mother, Lois, has today said that the latest hearing of her son's trial in court in Cairo was farcical. Peter Greste is one of three Al Jazeera journalists who are on trial on charges of aiding a terrorist organization. Their trial did resume yesterday, but only to be adjourned until later this month. And the Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott said in Shanghai that he is confident that rescuers know the position of flight MH370's black box. He said the search for the missing jetliner is probably the most difficult search in human history. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan Wheatley, and welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we'll be heading to Italy. Joining us on the line now is Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Cavallo. Welcome to the program, Ivan. Shall we start with the latest about what's going on with Silvio Berlusconi?
Yeah, well, right now with Berlusconi, he's is a sentencing on community service that looks like Berlusconi is going to be serving community service for this conviction that he faced in 2012 for tax fraud. It's sort of been this long drawn out process that people have been waiting to see whether Berlusconi would be under house arrest because due to his age at 77, the former prime minister was never likely to be going behind bars. But it looks like now this court in Milan will lay down in the next few days or few weeks this proposal to have him commit to doing some community service. So he would be out in the community doing some volunteer work. For example, he could be at a senior citizen's home, or maybe perhaps we would see him, because obviously there'd be media people following around, photographers, taking care of people with disabilities. So this is something that is coming down in the next few days.
Do you know what the arguments are? At some point, indeed, it did look like he would be going under house arrest. But do you know what the arguments have been for community service then?
Well, you know, it's actually interesting because you know, his own legal defense team was actually in favor of this community service sentencing. What is curious is that we have the European Parliament elections coming up in about 6 weeks' time. And they were hoping for, his allies were obviously hoping for a decision that would allow him to campaign, because Berlusconi is obviously hoping for a bit of a comeback, let's say, because you've seen the sort of anti-Euro, anti-European sentiment, and right now he's been trying to play that card. But it looks like he'll be having to do some community service in this time. So he won't be, let's say, able to dedicate all his energies to political campaigning.
The last year definitely hasn't been one of Berlusconi's greatest. How do Italians feel about him now?
Well, obviously he has a share of the public who are always going to support Berlusconi or feel, let's say, partial to him as sort of this charismatic leader on the center right. But his standing has obviously been diminished somewhat because, of course, we have the tax fraud conviction. He was expelled from the Senate, and also because of the ability of Italy's very young and very energetic Prime Minister Matteo Renzi to sort of put Berlusconi in a corner, because Berlusconi's had difficulties. We've been hearing from allies in Berlusconi's party that he doesn't really know how to deal with Renzi, and Renzi is a challenge that Berlusconi, sort of an enigma that Berlusconi can't really solve. And so for right now, his standing is amongst his sort of hardcore followers is still the same. But I think overall in the country, there's been obviously this loss of luster. Some of the shine has come off, and obviously his opponents, and there are a very large group of them, are very happy to see him sort of, let's say, slowly moving off stage in the country's political landscape.
Shall we leave Berlusconi for now and continue with aviation news? Alitalia and Etihad are still in discussions about possible investment by Abu Dhabi-based carrier in Alitalia. The talks have indeed continued, and at the moment the deal looks probably more possible than ever before. What is the latest on that?
Yeah, this has been going on since the beginning of the year, really. Etihad has been looking at Alitalia's books, doing the due diligence. They've been going over with a very fine comb, the problems, the debts, obviously with the problems with the unions in dealing with this carrier that was up until about 2008 was state run and then privatized. And it's a bit of a political football for Italian politicians, because any kind of sale or involvement of a foreign carrier is going to be a bit difficult. Of course, Air France and KLM, you know, had a stake, and there was the thinking that Alitalia was going to be sold or brought under the umbrella, let's say, of the Air France KLM group. But Berlusconi torpedoed that before. But it looks like now, because of the poor financial standing of Alitalia, that it really needs a savior. So it looks like the unions, whether it's the pilots or the flight crews, the stewards are going to have to probably accept job cuts that could be up to 2,000, because they really need the cash, and Etihad can offer half a billion euros probably right away to help them. And so Matteo Renzi had met just yesterday with the CEO of Etihad in Rome, and so it looks like next week we might have some news on a decision.
Do you know what Etihad would exactly want to do with Alitalia? Would it want to touch the brand Alitalia, or would it want to change the customer experience people get when they fly with that Italian company?
Well, I think, you know, I think the brand would stay the same. I mean, Italy is a very lucrative travel market, and I think the potential is quite large. You know, Etihad has already made investments in Europe. We've seen, for example, with Darwin, and also with Air Berlin, and you know, it has to compete with because Emirates has been moving into Italy very actively. They have three flights daily to between Dubai and Milan, and they have one flight onward from Milan to JFK in New York. Although just this week there was a decision in the Italian regional court in Rome. Saying that should be postponed or should be suspended after its 18-month trial period, which that decision was obvious, of course, was pushed by the Italian Airline Association. So rooting for Alitalia, but of course, if Etihad came in, they would probably be happy to have Etihad take care of that flight. I mean, brand Alitalia needs to be, you know, a bit polished. Its service side has always been quite weak. But I think, you know, the potential, if one looks at Italy and all the tourism destinations that you have between, you know, cities and seaside, I think that's a massive potential there that I think anybody, if it's done right and if they can sort of keep the unions at a corner, it would be a big gain for them.
And as Monaco 24 listeners probably have already realized, Salone del Mobile Furniture Fair has been going on for this week. And interesting numbers, actually. Germany has in recent years surpassed Italy as the biggest European furniture exporter. Ivan, what is your perception? What is your view? How is Italian furniture industry doing at the moment?
Well, actually, this week it's interesting to see at Salone, there's over 1,700 exhibitors, and we have about 30% who are foreign brands, foreign companies. The latest figures just out this week during the fair indicate that it looks like the Italians have just grappled that title back from the Germans in terms of being Europe's leading furniture exporter. So a bit of good news there.
Thank you very much. That was Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Cavallo with a wrap of some of the top stories making the headlines today in Italy. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favorite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barena, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
In Moscow, 1842 here in London, and 1342 in New York City. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. Now, you have probably walked across hundreds of manhole covers when you crisscross cities around the world, but what if you stopped one day and tried to see what is underneath? In Lisbon, normally just once a year, residents and tourists are allowed to enter one through one particular manhole cover that reveals a hidden underground city. The ancient Roman ruins date back to the first century after Christ and are some of the most spectacular ruins in Europe. So the question is, why is it only open to the public just one or two times a year? Joining us to learn more is Antonio Marcus, archaeologist at the Lisbon Archaeological Centre. He supervises the opening of these galleries. Welcome to the programme. So the obvious question, first of all, why are these ruins available for the public to see only a few times a year?
Because there are some structural problems. If we try to dry the ruins for a very long time, so we have to do it for short periods of time.
And exceptionally, this year, that manhole cover is open two times during this year instead of one. Why is this year so special? Why two times? Why the special treat?
I think it's because the responsible politicians, they finally saw that people wanted to see it, and there is lots of people always wanting to see these Roman ruins, and so they decided to do it not once but twice a year. Let's see if next year we can do it again, twice a year.
It sounds quite funny that you mentioned that the politicians have realized that there is
decide,
probably...
They decide.
But I think it's interesting that you mentioned that they have now realized that there is a lot of public interest to see what is actually going on over the underground, when I would think that there is a massive public interest. How many people are you actually able to let underground to see all that there is over there?
During the 3 days that we opened the monument, we have around 4,000 people coming.
And would there be more people coming in if they just had a chance?
Yes, surely, because we always close the queues much earlier than the time to close the monument. We close it around 3 or 4 or 5 hours. Before we close the monument, we close the lines, and there are always people coming that they wanted to see and trying to find a way to get in, but it's impossible.
And can you tell us, before I let you go, can you tell us what exactly there is underground? When you go there, what exactly are you going to see?
You are going to see the inner part of an engineering solution that the Romans adopted to create some land where they could build some buildings that they needed for the Olisipo, which was the name of Lisbon in the Roman period, Olisipo, for the Olisipo Harbor and for the commerce that was very important in this harbor, that was the most western harbor of the Roman Empire, facing the Atlantic and giving some help to the routes between the Mediterranean and North Atlantic.
That sounds very good, which leads me to my obvious next question, which is, when is the next time that manhole cover is open and that underground world is open to the public?
We hope to open it in September, in the last weekend of September, when it's the time for the European Heritage celebrations.
Thank you very much. That was Antonio Marcos, archaeologist at the Lisbon Archaeological Centre. We continue today's edition of Midori House with a bit of music. It's Friday, so why not start the evening off the right way? Here is Into the Blue from Kylie Minogue's latest album. This is Midori House on Monocle 25. We just heard Into the Blue from Kylie Minogue. It is Friday, so that means it's time for us to put a spotlight on some of the films making waves. Today, however, instead of turning our eye on Hollywood, we'll be heading to the Pacific Rim. Hong Kong International Film and TV Market is the annual festival devoted to the best in Asian film and television. Today we are joined by Samuel Jamier, who is film curator and co-director of the New York Asian Film Festival, who was in Hong Kong and chose three of the films that caught his eye. Thank you very much, Samuel, for joining us. Shall we begin our job straight away with Black Coal, Thin Eyes? What can you tell us about that film?
Hi, thanks for having me in the first place. It's a pretty amazing movie. I think it's already been described by many commentators as a game changer for the industry. It's a pretty told art house thriller. First of all, the way it was funded is quite interesting. Some of the backers include hip-hop artists like 50 Cent, Eminem, or also an NBA player, Carmelo Anthony. So it's quite interesting the way they put it together. And it opened in the mainland very recently and it attracted very wide audiences. So it's a really surprising movie, and it certainly caught the attention of quite a few people, and really managed to win over the critics, the film programmers, and now the audience. So it's a really interesting film to watch. And yes?
Yeah, you make it sound really good, basically. I think we should hear a clip of the film now.
听说其他厂那堆里头也发现了，那可不，清远、镇平、白水之城好几个厂都有。这玩意儿，东南西北，方圆好几百里。
So what I know of the plot of this film is that one of the stars had to gain 44 pounds, that is 20 kilos, to play one role in that film. So what exactly is happening in that?
Basically, it's a crime thriller. It's interestingly based. It's pretty firmly entrenched in art house territory in the way it is arranged, the composition, the photography, the characterization. Basically, they find body parts across the country, and they slowly try to figure out what's happening. And that's when the mysterious character of Kwei Lun Mei, played by Taiwanese actress Kwei Lun Mei, appears.
Mm. This segment of Midori House is basically about reviewing films, so that's why I'm asking the following question from you. If you were to rate this film on the scale from 1 to 10, how many points would you give it?
I would give it an 8.
Mm. That's quite good. Let's move on to the next film. You've got three films for us all together, so let's rush a bit so that we don't run out of time. Next one is Kano. It is by Umin Boya. What can you tell us about that?
It's one of the most popular Taiwanese films ever made. It's a baseball movie. Quite interesting, because you don't need to be a baseball fan or to be necessarily familiar with Taiwanese history to like it.
So it sounds like we actually lost connection to our guest. We'll try again in just a second, straight after this, as a matter of fact.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, desde Londres.
Holanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And here on Monocle 24, we are reviewing films from Hong Kong Film Festival. And Samuel Jamir is our guest. He was just explaining us about the plot of Kano, which is a film by Umin Boya. Do you want to continue from where we left it?
Yes, I was explaining a little bit about this baseball movie, which is perfect for people who don't necessarily like baseball. I think it has a pretty wide appeal. I was talking about its universal message about, you know, facing the odds and coming together as a team. That's basically the appeal of the film. A very emotional film. Though it runs at 3 hours, it's quite a good watch.
Let's listen to what it sounds like. Wow, I can feel the emotions. How many points from 1 to 10?
I would give it a 7. It's a little long, but if you stay on, it's really rewarding.
You know what? Let's listen to our next and final film for today straight away. This is The Midnight After by Fruit Chan.
我意思是大家每日穿一次幾話穿一齊正常。我想大家是時候停一停，面對我們見到的現實。他們全部消失了，現在只剩下我們這輛小巴和我們這麼多個。
Samuel, what was going on over there?
Oh, so the film is set on a minivan. It's a really interesting film, probably one of the most original pieces I've seen lately. It's a sci-fi piece, which is extremely rare coming from Hong Kong, and it has a strong comedic elements as well. It's pretty hilarious to watch. So one night, a few people on the same riding the same minivan back to a suburb of Hong Kong, Taipo, and they seem to go through some kind of time warp, and they find themselves, it seems, alone in the universe or something. They're trying to figure out. There's only 17 of them left. They're like kind of a representative of some of Hong Kong types, you could say, and they're just trying to figure out what the hell's going on there. It's really funny and extremely original.
Oh, you like it a lot. How many points do you give it?
I would give it a 9. It's as good as it gets as an apocalyptic comedy.
You sound very happy with that, don't you? Thank you very much. That was Samuel Jamier, who is just back from Hong Kong's international film and TV market. And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Jeffrey Kaufman and Nina Schick, who talked us through why Ukraine offered to devolve more powers to its regional government, and we also asked why US Secretary of Health is resigning from her post. Today's show was produced by Phil Hahn, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Janie Cho. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next up is The Menu with me. I sent Monocle's Fernando Pacheco out to East London to dine with some feline friends.
In the room we've got Wookie, who is our superstar cat. He's very, very handsome. We've got Donnie having a sleep on the windowsill, and I think Romeo might be underneath one of the tables playing with Petra.
Naughty Romeo.
And you don't want to miss what happened after that. Then at 2200 hours London time is The Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Andrew Miller. This show is back at the same time on Monday at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening and have a good weekend.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.